This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents The Moscow Offensive by Dale Brown, performed by Ryan Burke. This novel is dedicated to U.S. law enforcement and military and civilian security forces located right here in the United States. With all the turmoil and conflicts all over the world, it's easy to forget those who stand watch over our homes, businesses, and military and government installations in America. Thank you for your service, your watchfulness, and your dedication to protecting our country. We pray you never have to be used, but we are thankful you're on the job if the need arises. Being defeated is often a temporary condition. Giving up is what makes it permanent. Marilyn Vos Savant, American columnist. Prologue. Ginyar Changas, East Wind Manor, Isle of Man, in the Irish Sea. Late Fall, 2019. Willem Daneker glanced at the security guard seated across from him. A faint bulge beneath the other man's dark jacket showed he was armed. The Swiss investment banker hid a wry smile as he looked away, out through the tinted windows of the black Mercedes limousine. They were headed north along a winding, rain-slick road. Overhead, bands of storm clouds drifted slowly across the sky, soaking hills and valleys that had been continuously inhabited for more than 8,000 years. Over the long millennia, wave after wave of peoples, Stone Age tribesmen invading Gaels from Ireland, warlike Vikings, and then the rival Scots and English, had descended on this small island to hunt and fish and farm. But the old ways were passing fast, supplanted by wealthy newcomers and corporations lured by low taxes and limited regulation. Offshore banking and high-tech manufacturing were the forces driving the Isle of Man's economy now. And so, one by one, centuries-old estates and homes fell into the hands of rich businessmen from around the world, men like Daneker's host, Francis Xavier Reagan. Like many of the world's super-rich, the reclusive Canadian billionaire ruthlessly shielded his privacy. Very few people were ever invited onto his property, and they were always subject to close scrutiny. Tabloid journalists and other trespassers were met by armed watchmen and snarling dogs. Tires crunched on wet gravel as the Mercedes swung onto a long drive. East Wind Manor's age-darkened stone facade, turrets, and chimneys loomed ahead through the dreary gray light of the fading day. Beside its massive front door, a somber manservant stood huddled under an umbrella, waiting to greet him. Once indoors, out of the damp, Daneker eyed his surroundings with interest. Stone floors overlaid by beautiful Persian rugs, dark oak paneling, gleaming suits of armor, ornate coats of arms, and walls lined with expensive paintings conveyed an overwhelming aura of both vast wealth and a distinguished and ancient lineage. The wealth was Reagan's by right, the Swiss thought cynically. But since his immigrant Irish father had been nothing more than a day laborer, the noble lineage belonged entirely to this purchased house. Meeting the billionaire in the flesh did nothing to dispel that cynical view. Reagan, a tall, burly man in his mid-60s, nodded curtly to a chair. "Well, Mr. Daneker," he demanded, "what have you got for me?" Unfazed by this rudeness, the Swiss banker opened his briefcase and took out a thick sheaf of documents. The international consortium he represented wanted to buy two of the other man's privately held North American enterprises, FXR Trucking and Reagan Air Freight, and the Canadian wanted to sell. Though these mid-sized transportation companies were the original foundation of his enormous fortune, Reagan was not a sentimental man. In President Stacy Ann Barbeau's overtaxed and overregulated America, neither business was worth his continued investment of time and money. Donning a polite smile, he handed the documents across the desk.
"I think you will find everything is in order, Mr. Reagan."
"Maybe so," the other man said brusquely, "and maybe not."
Daneker frowned,
feeling uncertain for the first time. Both sides had already agreed on a price. Even more important, neither wanted to trigger any inconvenient scrutiny by government tax officials and regulatory agencies. What kind of game was Reagan playing now? The billionaire looked back at him with a cold expression.
Your clients like to live dangerously, Mr. Daneker. If they dicked around with me just for 12 more hours, they would have been shit out of luck.
The Swiss banker nodded. Reagan was due to depart on his annual sailing vacation at dawn the next morning. Every year before the worst winter weather hit the Isle of Man, he took his prized Dutch-built yacht, Bear Venture, on a weeks-long cruise south to Spain and then across the Atlantic to his second home in the Cayman Islands. And he made it a rule never to conduct any serious business while at sea.
"I regret the various delays," Daneker said.
He spread his hands.
"But when one is dealing with the different interests of so many different prospective investors, they are sometimes unavoidable."
Reagan snorted. For a moment, Daneker had the uncomfortable impression the other man knew he was lying. In truth, his real client had carefully controlled the timing of their negotiations. From the beginning, his orders had been clear. The deal must be concluded only in the hours just before Reagan set sail from the Isle of Man.
"Unavoidable or not, those delays are going to cost you," Reagan said, showing his teeth.
He stabbed at the contracts with one powerful forefinger.
"I'll sign these. But my asking price just went up 50 million euros.
Daneker raised an eyebrow.
50 million euros more? For what reason?
"For two reasons," the other man told him coolly. "First, your buyers have inconvenienced me. They wasted my time with bullshit. Nobody does that for free." Reagan leaned back in his chair, looking smug.
"And second, as a means of guaranteeing your clients' continued anonymity, it's obvious that this consortium of yours is nothing but window dressing, and ordinarily I don't do business with folks I don't know. But I'm willing to make an exception in this case. At a price."
Daneker kept his mouth shut.
"So here's the situation as I see it," Reagan went on. "Your real buyers have tried hard to hide themselves."
He shrugged.
"Maybe because they want to dodge some confiscatory taxes or nitpicking regulations. Or maybe because they're the sort of people who need new ways to make dirty money a little cleaner. So what I figure is that your mysterious principals don't really want my security people poking and prying around to identify them, Mr. Daneker."
He smiled thinly.
"My bet is that you're empowered to sweeten this deal to make sure it goes through on time, and without any inconvenient truths coming out. Correct?"
Daneker sat motionless for several moments, thinking fast. At last, he sighed.
"Such a circumstance was not entirely unforeseen. I am authorized to go a bit higher, but no more than..."
Reagan shook his head.
"We are not bargaining here."
His eyes were stony.
"The price goes up 50 million, or you leave empty-handed. It's your call."
"You are a hard man, Mr. Reagan."
The other man nodded. "That I am. Which is why I'm sitting on this side of the desk, and you're on the other, Mr. Daneker."
An hour later, Willem Daneker watched the dark stone walls and dim lights of East Wind Manor disappear behind him, swallowed up by night and rain. The Mercedes swung onto the main road, heading back to the airport where a private jet sat fueled and waiting. Frowning, he pulled out his smartphone and typed a short text message to Russian President Gennady Gryzlov, waiting impatiently in Moscow. 1,600 miles due east of the Isle of Man.
"Arrangements complete. Cost 50 million higher than hoped. Unfortunately, seller still shows regrettable curiosity."
Special Operations Ship Brodyaga, Prowler, far out in the Atlantic Ocean. Several nights later. Stars speckled the moonless night sky. Tiny points of light glittered in the midst of infinite blackness. Far below, in an inky darkness, an elegant craft more than 100 meters long and with a displacement of over 4,000 tons slid gracefully through long, rolling waves. Without any running lights illuminating her superstructure, the destroyer-sized ship was almost invisible. Seen in daylight and from a distance, Brodyaga looked like a luxury mega-yacht, not a warship. Her sleek lines and floor-to-ceiling windows mirrored those of other gleaming ultra-modern private vessels owned by the world's wealthiest men and women, including a number of Russia's leading industrialists and business oligarchs. In reality, Brodyaga was a disguised intelligence and special operations vessel for the Russian Navy. If necessary, she could discreetly slip in and out of foreign ports that were otherwise off-limits to Russia's surface combatants and spy ships. Nor was she routinely trailed by Western warships and aircraft while at sea, which gave her the necessary freedom of movement to conduct any number of covert missions, like this one. Brodyaga's red-lit combat information center was buried deep in her hull, far below the spacious staterooms and luxurious fittings used to fool foreign observers. Crammed full of sophisticated electronics and displays, it was a hive of quiet, purposeful activity. Captain Yuri Bezrodny leaned over the shoulder of one of his junior lieutenants. Carefully, he studied the low-light images transmitted by a drone flying 40 kilometers ahead. They showed a large, two-masted ketch sailing downwind at around 4 knots. His eyes narrowed. There were no other ships or aircraft within effective radar range. Their sonar reported no subsurface contacts, and the sea, state, and weather conditions were near optimal. He straightened up and turned to his executive officer.
Launch the strike team.
40 minutes later, a rigid inflatable boat comparable to the F-470 Zodiac rubber rating craft used by U.S. Navy SEALs sped across the sea at nearly 15 knots. A coxswain manned the tiller at the rear, and 7 more Spetsnaz combat frogmen straddled the gunwale, lying low to reduce their profile. They wore black wetsuits and night vision gear. Compact Groza 4 assault carbines were slung across their shoulders. Fitted with suppressors on shortened barrels, the weapons were designed for close-quarters clandestine action. Perched on the bow, Lieutenant Sergei Rozanov stared into the darkness as the inflatable boat rose and fell, cresting long Atlantic rollers. If his navigation calculations were even reasonably accurate, he should be able to see their target soon. There. Something. A fleck of brighter green against the green-tinged sky produced by his night-vision goggles flickered on the horizon almost dead ahead. The tiny shape vanished again as their boat slid back down into a trough between waves. But when it came back into view, the image was clearer, more distinct. He was seeing the sails of a large yacht running down toward them on a gentle breeze. Rozanov looked back at the coxswain manning the tiller. Slowly he flapped his hand twice. The petty officer nodded and reduced his throttle sharply. Their speed dropped. So did the nose of their near 50-horsepower outboard motor and its pump jet propulsor. Approaching from upwind like this should make it impossible for anyone aboard the yacht to hear them coming. But there was no point in taking unnecessary risks. Rozanov swung around again. The ketch's towering masts and slender hull were plainly visible now. They grew larger with astonishing speed as the two craft converged. Minutes passed with no sound other than the periodic slap of waves on their boat's rubber hull and the low, throaty growl of its throttled-back engine. The Spetsnaz lieutenant tensed. Any moment now. There was still no sign that they'd been spotted by anyone aboard the yacht. The two men on watch were either engrossed in keeping an eye on their rigging or, just as likely, dozing comfortably in the cockpit. 100 meters to go. 50 meters.
No.
Rozanov pumped his fist rapidly 3 times. Behind him, the coxswain swung his tiller across. Their assault boat turned smoothly through a tight half-circle, sliding in right alongside the big yacht. Quickly, one of the Russian commandos hooked onto its guardrail. Moving fast, Rozanov slithered up onto the deck and crouched low. They were tied up close behind the main deckhouse. No lights were showing. He unslung his carbine. One by one, the rest of his men swarmed silently aboard. Rapid hand signals sent 2 of them forward toward the bow. The other 4 followed him aft. The yacht's carbon fiber masts and enormous Decron sails soared above them. gliding soundlessly around the corner of the deckhouse, Rozanov tucked the stock of the Groza 4 carbine securely against his shoulder. The main cockpit was just ahead. Through his night vision goggles, he could see one crewman peering down at the navigation console and electronic sail controls next to the helm. Another sailor lounged on one of the L-shaped sofas fitted around the edges of the cockpit. He sipped appreciatively at a steaming cup of coffee. Without hesitating, Rozanov opened fire. His silenced carbine stuttered. Hit by multiple 9mm subsonic rounds at close range, the helmsman spun away in a gruesome cloud of blood and shattered bone. His coffee-drinking companion slumped back against the bullet-torn sofa, shot through the chest and stomach. The Spetsnaz lieutenant dropped lightly into the cockpit and spun toward the nearest companionway. It was open. Cat-like, he drifted down a short set of stairs into the main deckhouse. His commandos followed close behind him. They fanned out across the large, darkened room. A long, teak dining table ran down the middle, with plush sofas and armchairs in the corners. Rozanov took just a moment to compare what he saw with the deck plans he'd memorized earlier. Two more doors opened into the immaculately furnished room. One led forward into the yacht's crew quarters. The other passage ran aft, toward the owner's cabin and guest quarters. He nodded to his men, and then jerked a thumb at the forward passage.
Нет заключенных. No prisoners.
They slipped silently through the door one by one and disappeared into darkness. Almost immediately he heard wood splintering as they started kicking in doors. Silenced carbines cracked briefly, echoed by muffled groans and cries from dying sailors and servants. Without waiting any longer, Rozanov charged aft. He ran down a short hallway, broke through an oak-paneled door, and burst into a dimly lit and comfortably appointed stateroom. Bookcases lined the curving wall around a king-sized bed. There, an older man, big and gray-haired, sat bolt upright among the tangled blankets, blinking in surprise.
"Who the fuck are you?"
the old man growled.
"No one you will ever know, Mr. Reagan,"
Rozanov replied. Then he squeezed the trigger, holding the assault carbine firmly on target as it bucked back against his shoulder. Hit repeatedly, the billionaire sagged back against his torn, blood-stained pillows. White-faced, he struggled to breathe for a few seconds, shuddered once, and then died. Rozanov turned away. His senior sergeant met him in the corridor.
"The yacht is secure, sir. Everyone aboard has been eliminated."
"Excellent work, Yenin," Rozanov said. "Make sure all the bodies are weighed down before you dump them into the sea. Moskva doesn't want anyone finding bullet-riddled corpses drifting in the wind and waves."
The sergeant shot him a twisted grin.
"Well, that would sort of spoil the mystery of the thing, wouldn't it, Lieutenant?"
An hour later, the Spetsnaz team clambered back onto their rigid inflatable boat and cast off. They motored off to a safe distance and turned to parallel the now deserted yacht as it glided downwind. Rozanov glanced down at his waterproof watch.
10 seconds, he murmured. 5 seconds, 4, 3, 2, whomp, whomp, whomp.
The scuttling charges they'd placed in the bilge detonated one after another, ripping enormous holes in the yacht's hull from stem to stern. Slowly at first, and then faster, the vessel, with its sails still set, slid lower in the water. Within minutes it vanished beneath the waves, plunging down and down into the lightless depths of the abyss. Rozanov nodded in satisfaction. President Gryzlov would be pleased. Except for a few small bits and pieces of unidentifiable wreckage bobbing on the waves, nothing remained to explain the disappearance of Francis Xavier Reagan. 1. The world is in greater peril from those who tolerate or encourage evil than from those who actually commit it. Albert Einstein, theoretical physicist. Iron Wolf Squadron Assault Force, Moscow, Russian Federation. Spring, 2020. Moscow was burning. Fires glowed orange-red around the horizon in all directions. Each blaze showed where long-range standoff weapons launched by Polish and Iron Wolf fighter bombers and drones had slammed home, obliterating Russian surface-to-air missile batteries, military airfields, air defense radars, and command posts. Sun-bright flashes rippled across the night sky, lighting up a spaghetti-like tangle of wildly corkscrewing smoke trails left by missiles. blinded by the loss of most of their radars and by waves of electronic jamming and decoys, the city's surviving air defense units were shooting almost at random, hoping to score lucky hits. It was all they had left to fend off any airborne attackers slashing in to strike Moscow's center of political and military power, the Kremlin. But the Russians were too late. Their enemies were already on the ground, well inside their outer defenses. Vozdyshenka Street ran almost due west toward the tall red brick walls and towers surrounding the Kremlin. On one side of the street, three- and four-story buildings housed a mix of cafes, restaurants, shops, and government offices. A wing of the huge Russian state library ran along the other. Now wreckage and rubble blocked most of the street. Oily pillars of black smoke curled lazily away from mangled police cars and BTR-82 armored personnel carriers. Bodies were strewn across the cratered pavement. Flames danced eerily inside darkened buildings blown up by high explosive rounds. Nothing seemed to be moving. And then, a 12-foot-tall human-like machine emerged from the billowing smoke, moving with terrible, almost predatory swiftness. Two arms carried weapons, a 25-millimeter autocannon, and a 40-millimeter automatic grenade launcher. More equipment and weapons packs were attached to its long, broad-shouldered torso. A six-sided head, studded with sensor panels, swiveled intently from side to side, carefully scanning the surrounding streets and buildings. It was a cybernetic infantry device, a human-piloted combat robot, first developed by a U.S. Army research lab years before. Every CID carried more firepower than a conventionally equipped infantry platoon. Protected by highly resistant composite armor, its powered exoskeleton was far faster and stronger than any 10 men combined. A special haptic interface translated its pilot's smallest gestures into motion by the exoskeleton, allowing the robot to move with eerie precision and agility. Very few Russians ever saw a CID up close, and most who did died within seconds. Inside the robot's cockpit, Brad McClanahan concentrated intently, allowing data gathered by a wide array of passive and active sensors to pour into his mind through a neural link with the CID's sophisticated computer systems. Red targeting indicators blinked into existence across his displays. Each identified an enemy infantry squad or heavy weapons team frantically deploying along his axis of advance. They were taking up concealed positions inside buildings, planning to ambush him with machine gun fire and RPGs as he charged past. "Sorry, guys," he thought. "You can't run, and you can't hide. Not from me." The direct link with his sensors, coupled with advanced computer analysis, gave him astonishing situational awareness. It was like being gifted with a god's-eye view of the world. With difficulty, Brad fought down a sudden sense of wild, inhuman glee. Piloting one of these Iron Wolf Squadron combat robots was an incredible thrill ride. You couldn't help feeling an almost godlike rush of power, perception, and speed. But that way lay madness and death. CIDs were tough, but they weren't invincible. Some of his friends had found that out the hard way. "Come on, McClanahan, get your head back in the game," Brad growled to himself. The Russian soldiers scurrying across his path to the Kremlin were off balance, shocked by his sudden attack and their horrendous losses. But they were ready to break. But going in half-cocked was just a way to get killed. "Wolf 1 to Wolf 6 and Wolf 2, he said aloud, opening a secure channel to the other Iron Wolf Squadron war machines committed to this operation. "I'm roughly 400 meters from the ramp to Troitskaya Tower Gate, standing by." "Six copies," the laconic voice of Colonel Wayne Wack Maycomber answered through his headphones. "I've got the right flank."
"Two copies, Wolf 1. I am in position to guard your left flank."
A clear, crisp female voice said a heartbeat later.
"Submit we stop pissing around and finish this before the Russians fully wake up. Even they will not run around like idiots forever."
Brad couldn't help smiling. In combat, Major Nadia Rozek was tough, fearless, and intensely focused. Off duty and out of uniform, she was astonishingly passionate. But no matter where she was, the beautiful, dark-haired Polish Special Forces officer was a force of nature. When she made up her mind to do something, you either sided with her or you got the hell out of her way. There was no other choices.
"You heard the Major, McClanahan," Maycomber murmured.
Loud and clear, Brad agreed. Mentally, he commanded the CID's battle computer to assign priorities to every Russian defensive position its sensors had identified, ranking them by the danger they represented. In seconds, its software finished work that would have taken a human staff officer minutes. His targeting indicators changed color and shape to match those priorities. He took a deep breath, getting centered.
Attacking now!
Without waiting for a response, Brad sprinted up the street, speeding up with every long-legged stride. Dodging around a wrecked personnel carrier, he opened fire on the move. Rounds from his autocannon hammered an upper-floor window ahead, killing a lurking Russian RPG team. Shards of shattered stone and broken glass spilled onto the pavement. Another icon blinked insistently at the edge of his vision, highlighting a darkened doorway. 12.7mm heavy machine gun team, the CID reported. Threat level high. No shit, Brad thought. Rounds from that Russian MG might not penetrate his armor, but they could definitely damage or destroy his sensors and other equipment. Instantly, he swiveled the robot's torso and fired a 40mm high-explosive grenade into the opening. It went off with a dazzling flash. The threat icon disappeared. Still shooting on the run, he dashed across Mohovia Street, hurtled over a row of stubby metal pillars designed to block traffic, and landed in a wide stone-paved plaza. The Kutafia Tower rose ahead. This barbican was the Kremlin's main public entrance. Past its wrought iron gates, a gently inclined ramp sloped up to the tall spired Troeskaya Tower. To the right, treetops rose above a guardrail at the plaza's edge. That was the Alexandrovsky Garden, a narrow tree-lined stretch of walkways, flower gardens, and lawns occupying what had once been a moat around the old fortress.
Armored vehicles approaching, he heard Nadia Rozek report coolly. T-90 and T-72 main battle tanks. I am engaging.
Crack, crack, crack.
The sky on Brad's left lit up as she opened fire with her electromagnetic railgun, flaring bright white with every shot. Propelled at Mach 5, small, super-dense metal projectiles punched into the enemy tanks and tore right through their armor. One by one, wrecked T-90s and T-72s slewed across the road and shuddered to a stop, spewing smoke and flame.
"Targets destroyed," Nadia said. "My camouflage worked perfectly. The Russians never saw me."
Brad nodded in satisfaction. In a brutal, close-quarters urban fight like this, every edge counted. When stationary or moving, the advanced camouflage systems carried by their Skymaster Aerospace-built Mod 4 CIDs rendered them almost invisible to enemy IR sensors and even to the naked eye. Hundreds of small, hexagonal, thermal adaptive tiles overlaid each robot's armored skin, tiles that would change temperature with extraordinary rapidity. Computers could adjust them to mimic the heat signatures of trees, buildings, and other vehicles. In turn, paper-thin electrochromatic plates covered these thermal tiles. Tiny voltage changes could alter the mix of colors displayed by each plate, giving the CID a chameleon-like ability to blend in with its environment. But both camouflage systems lost effectiveness and drained too much power if they were used when moving at high speed, like he was now. Brad charged ahead, shooting up a glass-walled building used for security screening. The Russian soldiers who'd been firing back at him from inside were hurled backward, either blown apart by 25mm autocannon rounds or cut into ribbons by flying glass. Flashes winked at him from open arches below Troeskaya Spire. Rifle bullets thwacked into his CID's torso, shattering a couple of its thermal tiles. He spun away and ducked into cover behind the ruins of the security building.
"Drone imagery and scans downlinked," Maycomber radioed. "Looks like the bastards are reacting as expected."
Brad saw new data relayed through his neural interface appear on his displays. Their Iron Wolf assault team had half a dozen small and very stealthy drones orbiting high over the Kremlin, acting as their eyes and ears beyond the reach of their CID's sensors. At a glance, he could see that the colonel was right. Most of the Kremlin's elite guard infantry platoons and armored vehicles were deploying to protect the walled compound's gates. Anyone trying to breach those entrances would be met by a hail of anti-tank missiles, rocket-propelled grenades, and 125mm tank cannon fire. Not even the composite armor on their CIDs would hold up against that kind of firepower, which was exactly why Brad had never planned to conduct a real attack on the gates. With a wolfish grin, he darted away from the Kutafia Tower, swung over the iron railing,
and dropped lightly into the tree-lined expanse of Alexandrovsky Garden. The Russians had bought his feint. Now it was time to show them why they should have been thinking vertically instead. Brad sprinted south, paralleling the Kremlin wall rising beyond the trees. An anti-tank missile streaked after him, impacted against the trunk of a lime tree, and blew up. He dodged away and kept running. Preset targeting icons appeared on the massive red brick wall.
"Engaging Spider-Man protocol," he said wryly.
He raised his autocannon, quickly checking to make sure he had armor-piercing rounds loaded. Then he skidded to a stop and opened fire.
Whang, 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 whang!
Broken bits of pulverized brick exploded away from the wall. Ragged craters appeared at precisely calculated intervals, rising from near the bottom all the way to the top. Since the Kremlin's ancient defense barrier ranged between 11 and 21 feet thick, none of the rounds penetrated all the way through.
"But that's not the point now, is it?"
Brad thought with a silent laugh. Swiftly, he slid the autocannon and grenade launcher back into his weapons pack, flexed the fingers of the CID's hands, and then started climbing the wall, pulling himself up fast using the craters he'd just blown and the brickwork as handholds. He reached the battlements and scrambled onto a wide walkway used by guards to patrol the wall. There, he met a disheveled-looking soldier hurrying toward the distant Troitskaya Tower. The Russian was frantically trying to squirm into a bulky set of body armor. The man stopped dead, and he stared up at the huge combat robot in horror.
"Mater Borgia! Mother of God!"
Apologetically, Brad shook his head.
"Sorry, pal. That's not me."
Then he grabbed the Russian with one big metal hand and tossed him off the wall. Shrieking, the soldier vanished into the darkness. His despairing wail ended in a dull, wet-sounding thud. Brad winced. That had to hurt. He blurred back into motion and dropped over the other side, coming down on his CID's hands and knees inside the Kremlin compound itself. He was in a small courtyard close to the armory. Without further thought, Brad stood back up and pulled out his railgun. It powered up with a shrill, high-pitched whine. The autocannon dropped into his other hand. He looked around for any way out of the courtyard and spotted a big, solid-looking wooden door into the nearest building. One quick kick smashed it open, revealing a short, well-lit corridor. Bending low, Brad trotted down the corridor. He ignored a gaggle of panicked clerks and officials scrambling out of his path. They were no threat. None of them were armed. He smashed through another door and came out onto Dvortsaya Boulevard. The State Kremlin Palace, a massive and horrifically ugly Soviet-era glass and concrete edifice, loomed straight ahead.
"Blowing the snot out of that monstrosity would probably be doing the Russians a favor," Brad decided.
Instead, he swung away and sprinted north toward the Troitskaya Tower gate. His CID burst out into the open, right onto the flank of the Russian infantry and armored units deployed to block the gate. Targets crowded his vision. Brad opened fire with both railgun and autocannon, often shooting almost simultaneously at different targets. Tracked BMP infantry fighting vehicles and T-72 tanks shuddered and exploded, ripped open by railgun rounds. Infantrymen and anti-tank missile crews scattered in panic. A few, braver or more foolish, turned to fight. Autocannon bursts knocked them dead or dying to the cobblestone pavement. He stalked on through a nightmarish tangle of burning vehicles and bleeding soldiers, slowing only now and again to destroy new targets identified by his CID computer. Through the thickening smoke, he could make out the wooded confines of the Kremlin's Senate Square, and beyond that, a large triangular-shaped building, the Kremlin Senate itself. Its yellow walls were studded with tall white columns. Brad's mouth tightened. Signals intercepts and other intelligence confirmed that building was where Russia's vicious president, Gennady Gryzlov, was holed up, along with his closest advisors. He raised his railgun, aiming it at the upper floors. Three or four slugs ripping through those walls at supersonic speeds ought to kick things off with a nice bang. Suddenly, Nadia Rozhek broke in over the radio.
"Unidentified movement from the west detected. Moving to engage."
She sounded startled.
"I cannot get a lock. Repeat, I cannot get a..."
Her voice vanished, replaced only by crackling static. In that same moment, the icon representing her robot abruptly flared orange and then red. It winked out. Brad swallowed hard against the taste of bile. Somehow, some Russian son of a bitch had just knocked out Nadia's CID. He spun around, looking for the fastest way to her last known position.
"Drop it, McClanahan!"
Whack Maycomber growled. He sounded like death itself.
Continue the mission! I'm on this!
The icon showed the colonel's own CID was already in motion, rushing north.
Understood, Wolf 6,
Brad said through gritted teeth. He turned back toward Grislov's lair. It was time to finish this. More hostiles approaching, his computer reported calmly, reclaiming his attention. Threat access at 3 o'clock. Swearing under his breath, Brad glanced to his right. Three more T-72s had just appeared around the far corner of the Mammoth State Kremlin Palace. Whirring, their turrets spun in his direction, bringing their main guns to bear.
Ah, crap,
Brad muttered. He slid to the side and snapped off a quick railgun shot at the lead tank. Hit squarely beneath its long 125mm cannon, it blew apart. Twisted fragments of the turret flew skyward on a pillar of fire. One of the other T-72s fired back at him. The armor-piercing shell screamed low over his head, missing by less than a meter. Rocked by the shockwave, his CID staggered slightly and then recovered its balance. A coaxial machine gun chattered. 7.62mm rounds splattered off his composite armor.
Camouflage systems seriously degraded. Minor hydraulic damage to left arm, the computer told him.
Brad stayed on the move, veering unpredictably to make it harder for the Russian gunners to draw a bead on him. His targeting reticle centered on another T-72. He squeezed the trigger. Hit broadside, it burst into flame. Two down, one to go.
I see Major Rozek's CID,
Maycomber said starkly over their secure channel.
It's a total write-off. No life signs, and there's no sign of whatever killed her.
Brad nodded bleakly. Successfully bailing out of a damaged robot under fire was virtually impossible.
Understood, Six.
He fired again, smashing the last Russian tank. His threat displays were clear, empty of any new enemies.
I'm going after Grislov now. Watch my back.
Affirmative, Wolf One,
Maycomber replied. Then his voice tightened.
Holy shit! What the fuck is that thing? Am engaged!
Abruptly, his CID beacon flared bright red and disappeared. For what seemed an eternity but couldn't have been more than a second or two, Brad stared at his tactical display in complete consternation. What the hell was happening here? This was a nightmare. A total damned disaster. Angrily, he shook himself back to full alertness. Disaster or not, he could still kill Grislov and accomplish the mission. He owed Nadia and Whack Maycomber that much. He turned back toward the Russian president's headquarters, and then a stream of 30mm cannon rounds hammered the side of his CID with horrific force. Brad crashed into the edge of his cockpit as his robot tumbled off its feet and smacked headlong into the pavement. Warning, warning, sensors severely damaged. Hydraulic system function down to 30%. Ammunition and weapons packs offline, the computer told him. Camouflage systems inoperative. Armor breaches in multiple locations. Groggily, Brad shook his head, an action emulated by the robot. He forced himself upright. Damaged servos and actuators whined. More failure and damage warnings flowed through his dazed mind. Moving slower now, he spun around toward the soaring glass and concrete facade of the State Kremlin Palace. That was where the Russian bastards who just ambushed him had to be lurking. Fragments and bits of glass were still falling from one of the enormous second-floor windows. A tall, human-like machine leapt out through the opening and landed only meters away. Its spindly arms held an array of weaponry. Brad's eyes opened wide in shock. Oh my God! Before he could react, the other combat robot opened fire again, this time at point-blank range. Multiple armor-piercing rounds tore into his CID, hurling it backward across the cobblestones in a shower of sparks and torn bits of wiring and metal. Sensors were ripped away. Whole segments of his vision grayed out and shut down. Red failure warnings cascaded his bleary consciousness, each telling a dizzying tale of catastrophe. Stunned, Brad fought to regain some measure of control over his dying CID. Nothing worked. His computer systems were damaged beyond repair. Through his one working visual sensor, he saw the other robot leaning over him. Slowly, almost gleefully, it took aim with its autocannon, and then started shooting. Everything went black.
Battle simulation complete. a smooth computer-generated voice said in satisfaction. Total mission failure. Assault force casualties, 100%. 2. CID Simulator Complex, Iron Wolf Squadron Headquarters, Powice, Poland. That same time. The lights came back on. Senior exercise personnel should report to the main conference room, the computer said. Simulation debrief is scheduled in 10 minutes. Blinking in the sudden brightness, Brad McClanahan squirmed out of the simulator's haptic interface module. Now that he wasn't connected through it to the computer's and virtual reality setup, the touch of the gray, gelatinous membrane made his skin crawl. Strapping in or disconnecting always felt a lot like wriggling through a narrow tube full of body temperature oozy mud. At the bottom of the cockpit, he tapped a glowing green button. The metal hatch slid open. Carefully, he squeezed through the small opening, slid down a short ladder, and then, keeping his head low, crab-walked out from under the egg-shaped cybernetic infantry device simulator. Set in the middle of a large, opaque dome, the cockpit nestled inside of a weltering array of hydraulic jacks. Once clear of the complicated Rube Goldberg-looking assembly, Brad straightened up to his full height. For several seconds, he twisted and stretched his neck and shoulders and hips, working out the kinks and muscles that felt cramped and sore. Most of the time, he didn't mind being tall and broad-shouldered, but there were a few places where his build was a definite disadvantage.
Yeah, like cramped instrument-filled aircraft and CID cockpits, he thought with a wry grin,
which just happened to be where he spent a huge portion of his waking hours.
Smooth career move, McClanahan,
he told himself, heading for the door out of the dome. He could have been anything from an aerospace engineer to a bartender, but no, he'd wanted to be a combat pilot, just like his old man. He emerged into a cavernous hangar. Two more of the big domes crowded the vast space. Each looked very much like one of those inflatable planetariums used for traveling astronomy shows. Color-coded fiber optic and power cables snaked across the bare concrete floor, linking the domes to banks of big screen monitors and powerful computers. Ordinarily, the simulators gave rookie CID pilots a taste of what it was like to really command one of the big fighting machines. Once you were strapped inside, the combination of haptic interfaces, full motion capability, and three-dimensional virtual reality projectors provided an experience that sounded, looked, and even felt real. It was a relatively fast, cheap, and easy way to weed out newbies who couldn't hack the job. Today, though, the simulator domes had been repurposed to run veteran Iron Wolf pilots through a series of immersive combat scenarios. Fighting virtual battles avoided wear and tear on their expensive robots and on the Polish countryside. Live fire exercises with CIDs might be exciting, but they were hell on equipment, buildings, and the landscape. Even worse, open field maneuvers risked exposing key intelligence about the lethal machines and their advanced capabilities to Moscow's spies. Warsaw's military counterintelligence service was top-notch, but Poland was a free and democratic country. There was no way to build an iron curtain of secrecy around its armed forces, or those of its high-tech allies, the Iron Wolf Squadron and its corporate parent Cyan, a private military company. And Brad knew only too well that Russia and its ruthless, belligerent leader, Gennady Gryzlov, had every intention to pry deeply into their secrets. He felt his mood darken. For 3 difficult and dangerous years, the foreign-born pilots, commandos, and intelligence specialists who formed the nucleus of Iron Wolf had helped the Poles and other Eastern Europeans defend their freedoms against Russian aggression. Together, they'd stopped Gryzlov's forces cold, in the air, on the ground, and even in the strange digital battlegrounds of cyberspace. But the cost had been high. Too many of his fellow pilots and soldiers were dead. Right now, Poland and its allies were not openly at war with Russia, but neither were they really at peace. Sure, maybe nobody was actively shooting, slipping malware into power grids and banking systems, or lobbing bombs and missiles into cities, but that didn't mean the two sides were ready to beat their swords into plowshares. This current lull had lasted for more than a year. No one with any common sense believed it would last much longer.
Like the leopard who could not change its spots, Gennady Gryzlov wasn't going to abandon his ambition of making Russia the most powerful nation on the planet. The only open question was when he would make his next aggressive move, and what form it would take. Warily, Brad poked his head in through the conference room's open door. Waiting for the hammer to fall was starting to wear on a lot of nerves around the squadron. This morning's fiasco wasn't going to make anyone feel really warm and fuzzy. Wack Maycomber and Nadia Rozek were already seated at the big oval table. No surprise there, he thought. They both got killed in the sim before he did. Neither looked especially happy about what had just happened. Like most dedicated soldiers, both were intensely competitive and fiercely determined. Losing gracefully was for the other guys. Nadia glanced over her shoulder when he came in. A fleeting smile briefly brightened her blue-gray eyes. She patted the empty chair beside her.
"Come and join the ranks of the dishonored dead, fellow ghost."
Ruefully, Brad did as she suggested.
"Yeah, I guess that's us," he said.
"So do they give virtual wraiths government-issued chains to clank around in? Or do we have to buy our own?" Maycomber snorted and looked away. The big man's arms were folded across his chest. From the set of his jaw, he was just about mad enough to go off and bust a few heads in a bar somewhere, preferably one full of the meanest, nastiest sons of bitches around. Oh, boy, Brad thought worriedly. He knew that look. So would a lot of MPs and civilian cops around the world who'd ever made the mistake of trying to stop Wack from blowing off some steam. There were a lot of stories about the colonel from his younger days in the U.S. Air Force Special Operations Command. Some of the wilder ones were even true. Nadia's warm hand slipped into his. Almost against his will, he felt himself relax a little. They'd first met almost 3 years ago, when she was assigned as Polish President Piotr Wilk's military liaison to Sion and newly formed Iron Wolf Squadron. If he'd been asked way back then, he would have bet good money this was going to be one of those short-lived, stunning local girl takes pity on lonely foreigner kind of flings. Instead, whenever duty allowed, they were still spending almost every waking and sleeping moment together. So much, in fact, that Brad was taking a lot of flack from friends who wondered when they were getting married. He thought about that. If he ever got up the guts to propose to her, would she say yes? Or would she just laugh, tell him not to be an idiot, and then drag him away to their bed to take his mind off the impossible? Suddenly, Nadia shot him an amused, sidelong glance from under her eyelashes. Brad felt himself reddening. Christ, she was reading his mind now? Fortunately, before he could dig himself in any deeper, another man entered the conference room. Shorter than either Brad or Maycomber, the newcomer was in his mid-60s, with longish gray hair and a neatly trimmed gray beard. Moving fast, he crossed to the opposite side of the table and dropped heavily into a chair. From there, he surveyed the three Iron Wolf officers with a coldly displeased expression. Kevin Martindale, once President of the United States, now ran Sion. He was also a close advisor to Piotr Wilk and the other leaders of the fledgling Alliance of Free Nations. They all knew that the high-tech weaponry, innovative tactics, and intelligence expertise Martindale and his people provided were the margin between their continued survival as free nations and renewed Russian domination.
"Well, that was a mess,"
Martindale said at last, breaking an uncomfortable silence.
"Three CIDs wrecked beyond repair. Three top-notch pilots who would certainly have been killed if they were lucky, and captured if they were not. And all for nothing."
"Yeah, no kidding," Maycomber said through gritted teeth. He stabbed a finger back at Martindale.
"What the hell was that little bolt out of the blue bushwhack supposed to prove? That we can get killed in these tin cans? Tell me something I don't already fucking know."
Brad felt Nadia stiffen beside him. 15 months ago, during the last round of fighting with Russia, Wack Maycomber had led a raid on Perun's Eyry, a secret Russian cyber war complex buried deep in the icy, snow-cloaked Ural Mountains. They'd walked into a cleverly planned ambush. Charlie Turlock, one of their best friends, had been killed, unable to bail out of her damaged CID before it self-destructed. Wack himself had been captured by the Russians when his own robot was knocked out,
He'd been rescued, but climbing into one of the Iron Wolf war machines still put him on edge.
Adding those simulated war robots was my idea,
someone said calmly from the doorway behind them, coming to Martindale's defense.
Consider it a warning shot.
Brad hid a grin. His father, retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant General Patrick McClanahan, always did know how to make a dramatic entrance. Heads turned as the older McClanahan came into the conference room and moved to join Martindale. A motor-driven carbon fiber and metal exoskeleton supported his torso, arms, and legs, whirring softly as he moved. The exoskeleton, a bulky life support backpack, and the clear helmet encasing his head gave the impression he was wearing an eccentrically designed spacesuit. In a very real sense, Brad knew that was exactly what the LEAF, or Life-Enhancing Assistive Facility, was. A piece of advanced hardware designed to keep his father alive in a hostile environment. Only the hostile environment wasn't just the cold vacuum of space. It was the whole wide world itself. Years before, Patrick McClanahan had been critically wounded during an unauthorized retaliatory strike against the People's Republic of China. Most people thought he'd been killed. They hadn't been far off. His injuries were beyond the power of modern medicine to heal. Only a CID's automated life support systems had kept him alive. And so for year after long year, he'd been forced to exist inside a machine designed solely for war, robbed of all normal human contact, able to interact only through the CID's sensors and computers. Brad swallowed hard, remembering the sorrow he had felt as the man who'd raised him slowly disappeared into a shadowy, inhuman world of binary ones and zeros. This Skymaster's designed LEAF, risky and highly experimental though it was, had come along just in time to save his father's sanity. While the suit might look a little weird, at least it let Patrick McClanahan see the other people with his own eyes and touch them with his own hands. It also let him speak to them in his own voice. And that was a precious gift, even when what he said with it pissed them off.
"A warning shot?" Wack repeated angrily. "Nobody else has CIDs. Using them against us in the sim was a bullshit move, General."
Patrick shook his head.
"I'm afraid not, Colonel."
He looked around the small group.
"Gennady Grislov may be a psychopath, but he's also quite intelligent. He knows the kind of force multiplier our combat robots represent. Obtaining CID technology for his own armed forces has to be very high up on his priority list. In fact, I'm pretty sure that's what he was after in that ambush that killed Charlie."
"Maybe so,"
Wack agreed reluctantly, obviously wrestling with painful memories. Surrounded by overwhelming numbers of the enemy, he and Charlie Turlock had gone down hard, destroying dozens of Russian tanks and armored vehicles in a desperate last-stand fight.
"But there sure as shit wasn't a lot left of our gear when those bastards finished shooting us to pieces."
Patrick sighed.
"I've spent months analyzing the last few minutes of telemetry relayed from your CIDs, Wack, and I'm afraid more components might have survived intact than we first thought."
His mouth turned down.
"For example, Charlie's robot lost an arm to a Russian tank shell before it blew up."
"Yeah, so?"
"There are some indications that the impact point was high up, on the CID's shoulder, and not on the arm itself."
"In which case, the arm's actuators and control links might not have been severely damaged,"
Patrick said quietly.
"The same goes for your machine, Wack. It took a hell of a beating before the end, but the Russians could still have salvaged any number of functional or near-functional systems from the wreckage."
Brad stared at his father. "You really think Grislov could reverse-engineer the CIDs from a bunch of half-fried odds and ends?"
"Let's just say it's a possibility I can't rule out," the older man said. "But we can be sure his scientists and engineers are hard at work studying whatever they retrieve from the battlefield. And now that they know what our CIDs can do," he shrugged.
"What one man can invent, another can discover," Nadia quoted slowly, looking around. Patrick nodded.
"Sooner or later, hopefully much later, the Russians are likely to figure out how to build their own war robots.
And when that day comes, Grislov isn't going to be shy about using them in combat.
Facing off against Russian CIDs?
Brad grimaced. Well, crap, Dad. Based on what we just experienced in the simulator, that would really suck.
His father nodded.
Which is why we better start figuring out how to fight and win that kind of battle.
He offered Maycomber a wry, half-apologetic smile.
Hence the sucker punch today, Wack.
One thing still bugs me, though, Brad said, thinking back over the way the enemy CIDs had seemingly materialized out of nowhere.
You programmed in those Russian robots with the equivalent of our thermal and chameleon camouflage systems, didn't you?
Yep. Nadia frowned.
But we stripped the thermal tiles and chameleon plates off the CIDs we sent to Perun's Eyrie before the raid itself. In those Arctic winter conditions, neither camouflage system was worth the weight or power expenditure.
True, Patrick agreed.
So there's no way the Russians could reverse engineer our camouflage gear, not from anything they might have pulled out of the wrecks,
Brad pointed out.
Nope, his father agreed again. Then why throw that kind of high-tech invisibility cloak shit at us in the sim? Wack demanded. What's next? Force fields and plasma guns?
Train hard, fight easy,
Patrick said with a grin, quoting the famous 18th century Russian soldier Field Marshal Suvorov. Then his expression turned more serious. He tapped the exoskeleton sheathing his crippled body.
Look, Colonel, most of this complicated hardware is necessary just to keep me breathing. There is no way I'll ever fly a plane or pilot a CID again. So the way I see it, I have one job. Just one. And that's to do whatever I can to make sure the rest of you are ready for the fight that may be coming.
His lopsided smile returned.
Even if I have to cheat like crazy to do it.
He looked around the table.
Anyone here have a problem with that?
There was a moment's silence. Finally, Nadia cocked her head to one side, looking thoughtful.
No, what you say makes sense.
She matched the older McClanahan's grin with one of her own.
Better that we die 1,000 times in the computer than get our asses kicked just once on a real battlefield.
3. Reno, Nevada. The next day. Dr. Richard Witt stood uncertainly outside the door to an office suite in downtown Reno. A silver-colored nameplate showed that the space was leased to Peregrine Datalytics, ostensibly a small software research firm. He wasn't used to feeling this nervous. Witt's colleagues at Skymasters Aerospace often joked that he showed less emotion than the automations he helped create. He suspected many of them were just jealous of his ability to swiftly analyze complex robotics challenges and software problems, using impeccably rigorous logic. His fellow engineers were slower and less efficient than he was because they allowed trifles, personal relationships, rivalries, and ambitions to clutter up their working lives. Sweat beaded his high, bald forehead. Logic suggested nobody at Skymasters could possibly know or care why he had driven to Reno today. But this was one of those situations where pure reason provided less comfort than he would have wished. Before he could knock, the door opened inward.
Come on in, Dr. Witt.
FBI Special Agent Carl Sundstrom said genially,
You're exactly on time.
Witt awkwardly shook his hands, aware of how rumpled he must look compared to the FBI agent. The other man was shorter by a head, but trim and fit in a perfectly tailored navy blue suit and a crisply knotted red silk tie.
I don't think anyone followed me,
he blurted.
Relax, doctor,
Sundstrom said, offering him a quick, reassuring smile. He closed the door.
You're not here to do anything illegal after all, or even immoral.
Certainly not, Witt agreed stiffly. I'm a patriot and a concerned citizen. Still smiling, the FBI agent nodded.
And believe me, doctor, the powers that be in Washington greatly appreciate what you're offering us.
He shrugged his narrow shoulders.
I only wish others at Skymasters shared your sense of patriotism and loyalty.
Witt knew what he meant. It wasn't exactly a secret that Skymasters covertly supplied high-tech military hardware, including cybernetic infantry devices, to Cyan's mercenary forces. Those sales violated a whole slew of executive orders issued by President Stacy Anbar.